This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. You're listening to my guest today, guitarist Dan LaPelle, performing music of Bach, the Allegro from the Prelude Fugue in Allegro, BWV 998. My guest has been widely acclaimed for his guitar playing, but rather than stick inside the boundaries of the classical canon of music for guitar, he has chosen a path that promotes the newest music for guitar and beyond, embracing the music of our time. He has been a regular performer with ICE, the International Contemporary Ensemble. He's played with Bang on a Can and other top groups performing contemporary music. But he moved into a bigger circle when in 2003 he co-founded the New Focus Recordings label, a label dedicated to contemporary music. This has led to critical acclaim for the label, close collaborations with composers, and a platform whereby composers, performers, and ensembles can get their music and their music making out to a wider listening audience. Starting up and running a label dedicated to new music is not a way to make money. It's an endeavor and a labor of love, and shows passion for the music of now, with great peaks of success and joy, and treacherous pits of danger and hardships. All the music we'll hear on tonight's program will come from recordings available on the New Focus Recordings label, and I met up with Dan LaPelle at his apartment in New York City a few months back. Here today with guitarist and also founder of the New Focus Recordings label, Dan LaPelle. If somebody was going to start a record label in the 21st century, focusing on new music, not popular styles, but new music, I think it would only make sense if that person was also a practicing musician that they would play. I guess percussion would be one option, but it makes sense that they play guitar since that instrument is just pervaded every form of music in the 20th century. So it kind of makes sense that a guitarist would be the son of a label. So I thought we'd start on the guitar side, because with the guitarists I've had over the past years in Cadenza, it's always like, how did you come to the guitar? And then when you did come to the guitar, what were you listening to and what were you playing? Because usually that doesn't generate itself out of classical form or out of classical guitar.
Sure. Background. I mean, I came to guitar when I was around 11 years old, and I came in a similar way to a lot of American guitar players. I think I came through rock and roll. I heard Jimmy Page, actually not one of the Led Zeppelin records, but I heard, you know that record Outsider? It's like a record he made after Zeppelin broke up.
Yeah.
And I remember it was like in the car and my brother and I were in the back seat and I was like, I really want to know how to do that. Like I heard his solo.
Yeah.
And then he blabbed to my parents, hey, Dan wants to know how to do that, you know. Which of course was a good thing. But, but I mean, I was sort of really hungry for different stuff and I had some great teachers when I was young. I grew up in New Jersey in Montclair.
Yeah.
And I had some great teachers who fed me different things. Fed me like Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring arrangements and Wes Montgomery. And so like pretty soon, by the time I was 14, I was very into learning more jazz and more classical music. And that's where things sort of went from there.
Yeah, I actually started. Did you have to endure like the Mel Bay books?
And all that? Yeah, sure. Yeah.
What do you put through? Next Mel Bay colored, whatever color was colored.
Yeah.
So if you're playing all this stuff, you know, you come in like through the rock end of it. How does playing quote unquote new classical music figure into that? I mean, how do you?
Yeah, well, I mean, so, you know, by the time I'm like 13 or 14, I'm starting to take legit classical guitar lessons.
Right.
And then when it was time to decide about going to school, I sort of had to think to myself, would I rather study jazz or classical guitar in music school? And I chose classical guitar because I didn't really love practicing jazz by myself, which I recognize is a huge part of being a jazz student in school, right? I preferred playing with other people and with classical guitar, at least at the time, you know, I was mostly playing a lot of solo music. And so you get the whole piece right in front of you and you can sort of dig in and that appealed. And so from there, I would say getting into more contemporary music was sort of a function of a few different things. One is that I think the best guitar music is stuff that's written, actually originally written for guitar, stuff that's written since 1950. And this is the era where the guitar has been most integrated into otherwise sort of significant pieces. And the idea that I could play chamber music with other really great musicians. And I think also this, there's a sense that my continued interest in jazz figured into this because the sort of evolution of jazz and the evolution of new music and the different, I don't know how to describe this, but different sort of rhythmic vocabulary, different melodic vocabulary that you might find in all these different kinds of music sort of appealed to me. I wasn't as excited about like, okay, I'm going to learn this classic, you know, standard rep guitar piece that everybody plays and I'm going to be the guy who plays it like five clicks faster. Or,
right.
You know what I mean? It's just like, just wasn't as
exciting. You did some studies with the two guitarists. I mean, they've both been past Cadenza, I guess, with David Sturban and Jason Vio, who are huge components of new music for the guitar.
Sure,
I mean, that all rubs off, I assume, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so first I went to Oberlin Conservatory for my undergrad. I wasn't super aware of contemporary music yet. And then when I transferred over to the Cleveland Institute, Jason was actually just finishing as a student there.
Oh, okay.
And the teacher there was this guy, John Holmquist. And he actually left Cleveland Institute right around that time, and I studied with Jason a bit. And I don't know if it was really Jason's influence so much as my interest in playing with... There were great string players, particularly at CIM. And I saw my best opportunity to play with those people in a chamber music setting was new music.
Mm-hmm.
David Leisner also, I don't know if you're familiar with
him.
I studied with him and Nicholas Galusis when I was in high school. And they both introduced me to different new music stuff. But it didn't really, like, bite me until, you know, it didn't really grab me in a more holistic way until I was a master's student.
Just because he's from our area and we have him on the air often. But, I mean, somebody like a Steve Mackey, who is a really well-known composer, respected composer, but whose instrument is
the guitar,
electric guitar. Maybe
which
the first composer since Berlioz
us.
That somebody could say a composer of his stature, the instrument is the guitar.
Yeah.
You know, crazy like that. But, I mean, does that figure in as you're going through this to see somebody be actually out there as a composer, but also their instrument is a guitar? Now, I know it's electric guitar. But
yeah, I think I wasn't super aware of Mackey's music until like 2003 or so, which is after I moved back to New York. I lived in Ohio for a while and I came back here. But definitely the idea that he was, I mean, Physical Property is that piece with the Kronos Quartet, right?
Yeah.
That's like a landmark piece, I think, in terms of saying, hey, like the electric guitar can be like a legit instrument in a chamber music setting and all the other stuff he's contributed. And yeah, I think it's sort of changed the game in a lot of ways.
Here are the final minutes of a work by composer Adam Silverman called Three Fell Swoops, featuring my guest, guitarist Dan LaPelle, percussionist Aaron Lesser, and members of the ensemble Flexible Music, from a release on my guest's label, New Focus Recordings, called Sustenance, with music in addition to Silverman by Vineet Shende, Peter Gilbert, Oriana Webb, John Link, Joseph Pereira, and Seung Ah Oh.
Guitar playing, people may not realize that some of the ensembles that focus on new music need to or do carry a guitarist.
Yeah, sure.
So you've been with ICE, yeah. Which I guess in these days we should clarify is the International Contemporary Ensemble.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing to do with
nothing to do with hauling people out of their homes. But well, to go to the concerts maybe, but you know, just not to make light of it. How does that work with a guitarist? Because guitarists, like any, you could be on your own. You wouldn't need an ensemble. Other instruments need an ensemble to play
with. Yeah, right. Of course.
You don't need one.
I think what happened is I did my doctoral degree at Manhattan School of Music, and that's where I worked with David Starobin. And I was spending a lot of time with Mario Davidovsky's music.
Yeah.
And he's got some amazing pieces for guitar. He's got a synchronisms. He's got a couple chamber pieces. And he had gotten to know the directors of International Contemporary Ensemble, and they were putting on a portrait concert of his music, and he sort of put in a good word, hey, you should like connect with this guitarist, he's crazy, he likes my music, you know. Something like that. And we worked together, and it was a really great experience, and that was fairly early on in the group's development. I wasn't a founding member. I think that was 2005, so it's like about 4 years after they started doing stuff. It was sort of organic. I mean, it was like the same way that ICE sort of brought in a lot of its members, is that someone would play in a concert and people would really feel like it went well. And then after that, it was like, well, are there ways that we can generate more music that includes this instrument, which everybody recognizes a little bit of a like odd man out, you know?
Yeah.
And so I've been very lucky that they've been encouraging the composers who are working with the group to say, hey, why don't you, you know, consider adding guitar to this, or, you know. And sometimes it's dependent on maybe there's a piece that has guitar already on a concert and they're trying to get another piece with the instruments that are there, you know.
Right.
But it all starts with the initial sort of seed of like, okay, well, let's get this guy involved. So that's been very cool.
in new music wise, contemporary music, you covered a large, I mean, you said Davidovsky, but all the way to premiering pieces by Steve Reich and all the rest of this. So
I haven't actually ever premiered anything by Reich.
Did you do Electric Counterpoint?
I have a recording of Electric Counterpoint that I made. Yeah.
I mean, that's a wide gamut. It's kind of crazy, but I mean, we're just talking about the instrument here. When you have to focus that much technique and time and energy on music like that, especially a wide range of styles, I mean, how does that cut into... Because I've asked pianists this before. If you focus on new music, then how much does it take away from learning Chopin and Debussy? Sure. You know, I mean, what does it leave you time to do in other guitar repertoire or other guitar styles?
Yeah. For me, this has been like... I don't know. I guess in some ways I feel like it's a strength, but it's also my Achilles heel. I'm the guy who like goes into the restaurant and orders like more food than I can fit in my stomach, proverbially. You know what I mean? I've always loved doing a lot of different stuff and been attracted to a lot of different kinds of styles. And I think for me, I see them as the sort of component musical parts that make them that style. But I definitely recognize there's only so much time in the day. And so I used to play a lot of Bach, and I made a recording several years ago, and then there just wasn't as much time to be sort of like keeping those pieces in my fingers, and I came back a year and a half ago and did a new recording of Bach that I'm still working on editing, and I definitely found like, okay, I need to sort of like reinsert that floppy disk drive, you know, into my head. Like, this is the mindset I'm in, and I think certain things demand more complete attention than others. You know, if I'm in a freelance sort of state of mind, I'm just getting called to play a part in a chamber group, that doesn't demand quite as much of your practice time and your attention as if you're preparing a solo program and whatever.
Yeah.
But no, you're absolutely right. I mean, the gear switching is sort of a skill in its own that I've had to sort of work on.
Which would seem challenging and extreme for a guitarist, because there's so much music you could play in so many different styles.
Yeah.
You could.
On the other hand, I feel like maybe it's... just like with bassists, and also I think trombone players in a way, maybe percussionists too, it's almost something we have to do more than a violinist. There's so much work for violinists, right? And so a violinist can be like, you know, I actually only do, I'm like a chamber music person, or I'm a soloist, or I'm an orchestral player. But with guitarists, it's like the more likely thing is that every once in a while someone might need you.
Right.
But you don't necessarily get to choose exactly what they need you for, you know?
Right.
So being versatile is really helpful. And I think because I also grew up being interested also in jazz and to a certain extent to rock, though that sort of faded away a bit. It's just been something that's been natural to sort of make those switches.
Right. The oboe player gets the call. They're going to figure it's for music that they are trained to do on and all that. But a guitarist gets a call. You might want to say, well, what am I doing? You know, what style is it? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just, a lot of different things come up. I mean, I would imagine saxophone players deal with this too.
Yeah.
Though there seems to be a stricter division between classical sax players and non-classical sax players than I think there is in, say, bass or guitar.
Right.
I mean, there aren't that many really trained classical guitarists who can play other styles. But I would say more than... Actually, I don't know. I don't want to go on record saying for sure. But it is an interesting thing, and it's something I've both been happy to do and sometimes struggled with when I feel like, man, I just got to like push everything else out and just do this, you know.
What about composition?
I write a little bit. I always say like this, I compose, but I don't call myself a composer, like with a capital C. I arrange new material. That's the way I think.
All right.
Here's my guest, Dan LaPelle, and music of the Argentine-American composer Mario Davidovsky from his 12 compositions called Synchronisms for different instruments and combination of instruments. These are the closing minutes of number 10 for guitar. And this is from the first release on my guest's New Focus Recordings label, the CD called Resonance. Thank you.
you're doing this wide range of stuff and you're playing with ice and they're doing a wide range of stuff, if you're going to put this down for posterity, finding a record label, especially back, you know, almost 20 years ago. So you start this New Focus Recordings back in 2003.
Yeah.
15 years. So was it, you know, first of all, were you crazy? And second of all, was one of the major impetuses just control of what you could do and put out on record?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, the story is I worked really closely, both when I lived in Cleveland and also after I moved here, with a composer who ended up going to Harvard and studied with Davidovsky. So actually, he was the connection.
Okay.
His name is Peter Gilbert, yeah. And he teaches at University of New Mexico now.
Okay.
Really excellent composer, great all-around musician. And he wrote a companion piece for me, for guitar and electronics, called Ricochet, to the Davidovsky, so I could play it on a recital I had at Manhattan School of Music when I was a doctoral student there. And we just wanted to get a really great recording of it. And then I was like, well, let me also record the Davidovsky because, you know, I've been working so hard on it and I want to have, like, a document.
Right.
And that turned into, okay, there was this other really great piece by Manhattan School faculty member Nils Vigeland that had never been recorded, and I ended up playing the premiere of it. And so it turned into a CD. And this was the second CD I'd made, but I'd made an earlier one just without a label. I just released it myself. And we're working so hard on this. And, yeah, it's sort of like I knew there was no commercial label at that point that was going to necessarily be interested in a doctoral student's performance of Davidovsky, Carter, and a lot of music they wouldn't be aware of.
Right.
I certainly didn't have the money to pay them anyway.
Right.
So I just wanted to do it myself. And then at some point, we had a conversation. Well, do we put a label name on here? And it's like, oh, I guess why not? It makes it look like more legit, you know? And that was the first record. That was our 101.
Yeah.
And from there, I did a couple others. And then that was right around the time that I met the folks in ICE. We collaborated on a record of some of the chamber music with guitar that we'd been playing. And that record's called Abandoned Time. So there's a piece by Dai Fujikura on there. There's another Davidovsky piece, Festino, Magnus Lindberg piece, a Sarajevo piece, and a Du Yun piece. So a few of those pieces had been recorded before, and then a couple of them were premieres. And I think from there, more people started to sort of be aware. I also had this other group, Flexible Music, guitar, saxophone, piano, and percussion. And we had done a lot of commissioning, and we put out another record at the same time. Those were all premieres. Those two records, I think, I mean, I'm not going to say we got like a lot of attention. We didn't. But enough among friends for them to say, hey, that's cool. Like, I never thought maybe we should release on Dan's label too, you know? And then I was like, okay, yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but like, let's try it. What would that mean? You know?
Right.
And then you go through the process and you're like, okay, I think I start to understand what this means. And it gathers steam from there.
So it was a true 21st century thing. It really just started with networking of.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I mean, maybe the 21st century part of it was that from the beginning, even in 2003, it was pretty clear that the marketplace was going to really change in terms of physical sales versus digital sales. Because that's like 2003 is around the whole Napster thing, I think, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's already clear that downloads are going to become at some point sort of eclipse physical.
Right.
So from a sort of business point of view, I knew it wasn't going to make sense as a label to be like investing in an actual like storehouse and physical discs. So I had to try to come up with a model that made sense for that.
Right.
So in that sense, I think I was lucky. Had we done it like 10 years earlier, I think I might have adopted an older model and found myself, you know, holding a lot of debt or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I want to get to the whole multi-platform thing, but no one does this for money. Like you said, this is a labor of love that you do the label. So as you started to get off the ground and projects were coming your way and friends were saying, hey, record this. I mean, was there then this coalition of we can sustain this, we can keep going, we're going to have a, what's the diversity going to be on the label? I mean, you have to make decisions like
totally.
That.
Yeah, of course.
So, I mean,
I can say without hesitation that there wasn't much of a long-term plan during those years.
Yeah.
I had to find out from other people that it seemed like I was running like a real label. And I still didn't believe them for a while, you know? So early on, we were just distributing through CD Baby, which was pretty new.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, CD Baby's still around.
Yeah.
But back then, it just seemed like the easiest way to get stuff out.
Yeah.
And we also had an Amazon Advantage account. So, like, if people ordered CDs, that meant literally going to the mailbox and sending them off. And the way Amazon Advantage is set up is by the time you do that and they take their cut and you pay for the shipping, like, you basically don't make any money at all.
Right.
Eventually, David Starobin, who runs Bridge, and his wife, Becky, saw that I was doing some of this stuff, and they said, hey, maybe we should connect you with our distributor, Albany, which was extremely generous. They've been generous the whole sort of trajectory of this. So we first started working with Albany, and then a few years after that, someone connected me to have a conversation with Sean Hickey at Naxos, and we decided to move over to them. I would say that's 2010, I think. That's the moment where I guess it became more of a, I had to figure out, okay, I guess I'm actually like sort of running a business now. I have to really figure this out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's always every step of the way been, what does this need to remain sustainable so that the people involved can continue to justify the enormous amount of time, you know, myself included, but that we really make it as easy and efficient as possible for people to put out records. So that's been the sort of guiding principle. And, you know, I'm always tweaking it, basically.
And the old school model of this is Naxos distributorship, where you're a small independent label, that you go to a big distributor like that, all of a sudden your thing is being seen, your titles are being seen by people you could never reach, you know, in a direct mail or type of thing. You know,
right.
Any kind of success. It's been a good step and been a good partnership, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, for us?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the idea, my idea there was like, hey, we're all putting so much into these recordings, you know, not just financially, but just blood and sweat and heart. And if we can get them out to a wider audience, then we should be doing it. And also thinking like, okay, the industry's changing a lot, and Naxos might be one of the only distributors that is able to sort of ride this because of the sheer volume. You know, if things are going to get down to micropayments, then they're going to be in a better position to stay sustainable than than a lot of other, which I think has been true. Bridge ended up moving over to them as well.
So. Right, right. My guest, performing as part of ICE, the International Contemporary Ensemble, in music of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Chinese-born international composer, multi-instrumentalist, vocalist, and performance artist, Yu Dun. The opening minutes from her Vicissitudes No. 1, this from a recording on the new Focus label called Abandoned Time, featuring my guest, guitarist Dan LaPelle, and ICE. Thank you. sustainability thing is how now are decisions made on what comes out on New Focus? How do you make decisions that this CD is going to appear on the label, these composers?
Yeah, I mean, there's the main catalog of New Focus recordings, and then there's a few imprints, too. For instance, as the label grew, ICE has this sort of amazing capacity to be both an ensemble but also a presenting organization, right? So it seemed appropriate for me to set aside a space for ICE to be able to curate its own recordings without having to sort of pass through me, even though I'm a member,
right,
as like the gatekeeper.
Right.
So I created an imprint for ICE called Tundra. So those recordings are approved through ICE.
Right.
We distribute Seamus Society for Electroacoustic Music, their recordings too, and that's approved through. But for the actual sort of main New Focus catalog, it basically comes to me. I mean, there's a lot of different factors, I suppose. Sometimes it's, okay, here's an artist who's worked with the label before, and that already obviously gives them a sort of leg up, and I'm probably more willing to give them a certain amount of purview in terms of, hey, I really believe in this project, let's do this. For instance, actually, I gave you Jacob Greenberg's Debussy, Berg, Schoenberg, and Webern project, which is an awesome 2-CD set. Jake has been recording with New Focus since pretty early. If that had come to me as like a random submission of somebody I didn't know, I probably would say, hey, well, this is sounds like a really amazing project, but it's not really exactly what we do.
Yeah.
But it's Jacob, and he's got a big presence on the label, and he's a wonderful musician, and he told me the idea, and I was like, yeah, let's definitely do this.
Yeah.
So there's some of that, but then I would say more generally, there isn't really a stylistic agenda necessarily, because we've got a pretty wide range. We've got everything from Robert Hanstein to, you know, Alex Sigmund or Wang Lu or Anthony Chung. I mean, I'm looking for stuff that is sort of the best incarnation of that genre, I guess, in a way. I mean, or that aesthetic.
Right.
So the one I like about Hanstein's music is that he is writing in this sort of post-minimal milieu, right?
Yeah.
But I find when I listen to his music is all these nice little surprising corners and little unexpected things that decisions he decides to make that keep me really engaged. So his choice of limiting his compositional materials somewhat in the grand scheme of what's out there today doesn't really matter to me. What matters to me is what he does with the material itself.
Right.
So that's, I guess, the sort of operating principle. A lot of times, though, if something's coming to me from a performer, the emphasis is sort of different. It might be a wider range of aesthetic. Though, honestly, from the beginning with New Focus, my preference has always been sort of pretty tightly curated programs. I think that was where we started the label, and that's what I try to reset it back to whenever I can.
So like the Davidowski Gilbert thing. Was, you know,
yeah, something like that. Or the title of that record was Resonance.
Yeah.
So the idea there was really use a very close mic setup on the guitar so we could sort of get inside the way that different harmonies and voicings resonated on the guitar. And so, yeah. But as you go on, there's a lot of great projects that come in that are not necessarily fitting into that template. And I'm not always going to reject it because it doesn't reflect exactly what I started the label to do, you know.
But there's some factor, just an ear factor.
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah. I hear something
making a decision.
But I end up saying this a lot because we get a lot of submissions that we can't take on. I end up rejecting like a lot of really, really good recordings, and I try to like emphasize. I don't know if people believe me or not, but I try to emphasize if I'm saying we can't take it on, there's no reason to feel like that's a rejection. It's also a company, it's a business, and there we have a limited capacity and. You know, we have to watch out to not flood too much stuff out there, which is a danger, you know. And sometimes something is great and really worthy and just not quite the right fit or maybe not quite the right timing or whatever, you know.
Well, it's nice, too. I mean, New Focus isn't a large label, but you've got the umbrella big enough that you fit all these little labels kind of underneath it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of self-distributed, so it's just nice. It gives them security that, you know, they can continue. It's a nice idea.
Yeah.
So my guest Dan Lapel's New Focus Recordings label is not entirely dedicated to the newest music, but does promote the artists on the label in repertoire and composers standard to the classical core. Here are two short examples. From a 2-CD set featuring pianist and composer Jacob Greenberg performing music of Arnold Schoenberg, his Book of the Hanging Gardens, and Alban Berg, all sitting next to music on the set of Claude Debussy from that French composer's Preludes Book 1, the well-known The Girl with the Flaxen Hair. And following that, from a new focus recording of songs by Franz Schubert, we'll hear Heidenröslein, Deutsch Listing 257, as sung by soprano Toni Arnold, accompanied on guitar by my guest today and founder of New Focus Recordings, Dan LaPelle.
Back to the 21st century, you have to probably have to deal with.
Yeah.
As a label that's putting out hard physical CDs.
Sure.
There are downloads.
Yeah.
There's also streaming.
Sure.
And all of those can create real headaches in different ways.
Oh, yeah.
So before how New Focus handles that, your thoughts on it, maybe just for our audience who don't really grasp the difficulty right now in those three different areas and how you have to balance them, maybe just explain the difficulties or benefits of those three different areas and then how you're doing with them. So putting out physical discs,
yeah,
downloads, where right. you just, here it is, download it to your computer, do what you want with it,
mm-hmm.
or streaming, where there's something streamed which you might have a request, you know.
Sure. I mean, for us, I mostly leave it up to the artists.
Yeah.
If artists say, well, we don't want to do physical at all, I say, great, we'll just do digital only. If they say we don't want our stuff streaming, I say, okay, cool. But you should know if you take your stuff off of Apple Music, iTunes won't sell it as a download. This is like a proprietary quasi-mobster move that Apple does in the industry. And then usually they say, oh, I guess we have to have it on Apple Music, you know, yeah. because everybody wants it on iTunes. Interestingly, I think physical seems to be doing better from what I've been reading. And streaming, obviously, is getting a bigger and bigger market share. I think downloads are the thing that is coming down, which sort of makes sense because you're downloading something to your computer that you could listen to for free, almost for free on your computer.
Right.
So unless you're not connected to the internet, which is like less and less rare, and also Spotify has a feature where you can hear the music even when you're not online. So unless you're really concerned about audio quality, which most people aren't, the idea of paying $9.99 for a download versus streaming it, I think from the customer's point of view, doesn't make that much sense. iTunes and Amazon MP3 and even Spotify, it's like playing the lottery in a way, right? They have the capacity to put your release in front of many more people if they decide to feature it.
Right.
So if Spotify puts it in a new classical releases this week, all of a sudden, all the other stuff on that record maybe luckily gets 1,000 plays if things are going really well. But that one thing that's on the playlist might get 150,000 plays in the course of a couple of weeks.
Yeah. To a lot of our listeners, it's still very new terrain, even though many people have been dealing with it for a decade.
Yeah.
It's interesting you say that downloads are kind of flatlining and that physical CDs, the guy who owns your distributor, Klaus Heyman, I've had on Klaus a couple of times. I just had him on a couple of years ago when they were having a big celebration for him. And he says, you know, physical discs, CDs, 5-10 years at the most.
Right.
So, I mean, you have that, too. You're running this label, which you know one facet of it is on a death march.
Yeah, yeah. but I guess I've known that in a way since the beginning, so
true.
I feel
lucky.
You've
known it since you started in 2003.
And yeah. I mean, if I look at other, like Bridge or other labels that have been around a bit longer, I feel like if they were around for enough years that they could actually make money off physical CD sales, then they're probably okay, even if they still have a lot of inventory and they have a physical space. Because things were pretty good in, like, the 80s and 90s. I don't have hard facts to support this, but in my mind, I have to imagine if somebody came around in 1998 and was like, I'm going to build a record label, and I'm going to, like, pay for the physical product and pay for a storage space and have a lot of inventory, and then within 2-3 years, they're going to see, whoa, the bottom dropped out.
Right.
So luckily, by the time I started this, or by the time we started this, and also because I was business averse, basically. I didn't really want to run a label business. So I was trying to figure out ways to not find myself under a lot of overhead.
Yeah.
Luckily, that led to making the right decision with respect to physical, I think. So we've still put it out for two reasons. One is the artists really want it. And a lot of our artists also have jobs teaching in institutions, and they need to actually produce a physical CD for various institutional reasons. And critics prefer it still, which is an interesting thing that's like, and often radio stations too.
Oh, you do too, yeah.
Yeah. So when people say, well, what about digital only? I usually encourage them to at least do like 100 unit run of promotional CDs. I think it's because critics have so many emails coming in that like they have to weed things out somehow. It's like, okay, well, if something shows up in my mailbox and it's on my desk, then I will see it over and over again and maybe give it a time of day.
Yeah, and from the radio side, and it's a totally lazy reason. When you get the physical disc, everything's done for you.
Yeah.
When you have to do the downloads, we're interested in maybe the liner notes and information about the artist, about the composer, about the piece, timings. That's what we have to worry about. And there is that. And we have to ingest that and find a place to live.
But actually, this is really good for me to know, because now I'm wondering, maybe we have a way to make this easier on the digital end. Somebody has to enter the info from the physical anyway. Right?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, most times now, there's...
the metadata is on the disc.
Yeah.
So. But hypothetically, if somebody from a label sent you a sort of zip file that had downloaded tracks in it and like a track list with timings and all the metadata and whatever, then you would it would be just as good for you to then...
Yeah, but you still have to take it down and do something with it. Where this, goes on the shelf and there's space for it.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, everything has to do with like existing infrastructure, right? Yeah. The stations were mostly built to support this, this format, so...
To another recording on my guest's new Focus label that has taken a recent poignant twist, a CD called Solitarius, music of the Lithuanian composer who made her home in Norway, Dalia Radonikytė Witt, who just passed away weeks ago on September 7th. This is her Prima Cum Lumina Solis, or At First When the Light of the Sun, performed by my guest, Dan LaPelle.
So, I mean, you see this going on for a while? With
the label?
Yeah.
I mean, 4 or 5 years ago, I thought that it was over.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to peter out. Like, industry-wide, I just thought, well, I don't see why this is going to continue to happen. From the point of view of the artist, I thought also, if it's so expensive to make a studio commercial CD, that I predicted that we were going to see more and more live recordings being released, and that everything was going to go digital and to cut down on costs. And I will say that when we release something that has pieces where there's like more than, say, 9 or 10 players, almost all of those recordings are live recordings, because very few people can really fund recordings of in new music of pieces for more forces than that.
Right.
But outside of that, people still really want to make like a sculpted CD. And so my prediction does not seem to be borne out. Now, I can't really predict what's going to happen to New Focus, because this is a fickle business and other labels come and go and people decide to go. But I think the industry in general seems to be doing pretty well. Well, in terms of volume of releases.
Right.
People are not stopping putting out records. If you want to judge it by, like, revenue that comes back to the artist, it's a catastrophe.
Yeah.
Absolute catastrophe.
Well, I go back to the labor of love.
Yeah.
On everybody's level. Keep it going. It's good stuff. And so keep going as long as you can.
Yeah.
And of course, you'll appear on many of the discs, playing guitar and all that.
Yeah.
I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. First is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been chatting, but with somebody from the past who you never had a chance to talk with.
Who would I?
Yeah, well, first one I asked that.
Yeah, I should have thought about this. Let me think.
Usually a name pops up. If you think about it too long, lots of names start to come in, but, you know, there's somebody.
Who would I ask? I mean, I guess a few names are popping up in my head, but then I'm like, do I really want to talk to that guy? Like, Boulez, I think, is a fascinating guy. Oh. Schoenberg would be very interesting to talk to, I think. Hmm. Okay. Stravinsky, too. Bach, obviously, but he's probably too busy.
Well, yeah, I wonder what Bach's reaction would have been knowing his stuff was played on a guitar.
Yeah, well, I like to think that he would
say, let me write for that, or would he...
I think, I mean, historically, it seems like he was sort of up for a lot of, you know, he did a lot of rearrangements of his own stuff for different instruments,
I
hope he would be cool with it.
Final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview on this program fills their life with music. You are busy on many fronts, as our listeners have heard. When you have to get away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do? You need to step away.
Yeah.
From the business or the music or whatever you're doing, you know.
Go check out a movie or, you know, take a bike ride in the park or, you know, maybe take a train upstate and take a hike or something or go to the beach.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe do stuff outside. Yeah, I mean, you need to get away sometimes for sure.
Yeah, because you've got other concerns besides performing. You've also got the whole business then going on too. So it's like your email and your texts must light up at times.
They have a way of doing that. And the funny thing is that I guess I'm old enough to have had a whole childhood and even the early part of my career before the sort of pervasiveness of this media in all your mental space during your waking hours. But young enough that, like, I can't say that everything is sort of solidified without it. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
I think if you're maybe in your late 50s or early 60s, then maybe you've sort of had a career that was established before all this stuff started. That's not really true for folks. I'm 42, so we're sort of right at the edge there. Yeah, I mean, certainly with social media, email, when I was in my early 20s, that was already like the way to get in touch with people, and I think largely. Social media has been like a big adjustment over the last 7 or 8 years. Because when it first came on, Friendster was the first thing I was part of. And that sort of was a joke, right?
Yeah.
The notion that that would become such an important professional tool took me a long time to get used to, I think.
Yeah.
And I think probably strikes people in my generation really differently than it strikes people who are 10 years younger than me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm almost turning 60 next year and... I still remember phone books and maps and you know, answering machines and encyclopedias.
All things that are completely defunct.
Yeah.
But I think the difference is that your time and your mental space was your own then. So, sure, you had a lot of stuff you had to take care of, but if you left your house and somebody left, you might not get that message for hours. You know, or days.
Days, exactly.
And the creative journeys you could go on at that time were very different.
Dan LaPelle, thanks for taking some
time. Hey, thank you. My pleasure.
Guitarist and founder and director of the New Focus Recordings label, Dan LaPelle. You can find out more about him at his website, danlapelle.com, and check out all the recordings on his label, New Focus Recordings, at newfocusrecordings.com. Here's music mixing new and old, as I'll leave you by going back to that first release on my guest's label, a CD called Resonance, the final minutes from the final movement of Nils Wiegland's La Folia Variance for guitar, performed by my guest today, Dan LaPelle. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you.